Okay, we're going to start here on two lines from the bottom of Zayin Amud Bet. Ushbizichnei derav, atala kameh dedino. So Rav's host, a place where he had stayed in a bed and breakfast, someone had hosted him before, he had a relationship with the individual, and he came before Rav to adjudicate a case for him. Amarlo, lav ushbizichnei at? He said to Rav, aren't I your host? Aren't I the person that you stay by? Amarlo, it. Rav said back to him, yeah. Amalei, dina itle. So then the Ushbizichne, this host of Rav, or the person that had taken care of him in this situation, says to him, listen, I have a case that I want adjudicated. I'd like you to preside over the case. And just, you can look on the side here that the Rashal had a slightly variant girsa over here, whereby the conversation went in the opposite direction, which is Rav was the one who posed the original question. And then the individual responded in the positive or the affirmative that he was someone who had hosted Rav. And then Rav says, Ma bait, what can I do for you? How can I help you? And then that individual responded, I need you to adjudicate a case. But the girso does not impact on the remainder of the Gemara. Amalei, psilnalach the dino, says that I'm disqualified from judging this case. As the Balei Tosafot point out over here, that marchinkaya atzmo, he wasn't absolutely disqualified from the case. There was no bias necessarily, and he's supposed to be impartial despite their relationship, and there was no shochad that was being paid over here. Nevertheless, he did it to be above and beyond any reproach. He made sure that he recused himself from such a case. Avam min adin lo mifsa, Tosfot says, but miikar adin, from the letter of the law, he was not disqualified from the case, but he thought it better to recuse himself from the case. Amalei Rav the Rav Kahana, pog dainei. So Rav tells one of his talmidim, Rav Kahana, you go ahead and take care of the case, you adjudicate the case. Chazir dehavu gois be. So Rav Kahana saw that this litigant was a little bit haughty, or he was a little bit sure of himself, because he thought that he had the whole thing wrapped up because of his relationship with Rav. Samalei, itzaita, itzaita. He says, either you listen to what's going on over here, and you act appropriately, below, and if not, mafkitna lach Rav meunich. I'm gonna pull Rav out of your ear, or the way that Rashi learns it over here, you can see that from the Aleph in the Bach, which is mikochacha, that onech is not your ear, but rather from your strength. So one way to learn it, the way that Rashi is suggesting over here, according to the Bach, is that I'm gonna dispel your misunderstanding that Rav is your safety net, or Rav is your power over here. I'm going to eliminate that power, or I'm going to make sure that Rav has no say in the matter. So that's one way to learn it. Or the other way to learn it is I'm going to pull Rav out of your ear, which in essence means that, the way that Tosfot says it, Tishamtinalach, that I'm going to put you into excommunication, and that's what the Rashi says at the end as well. So therefore, the nude or the nidui, he's going to put him into excommunication, which means I'm going to pull Rav out of your ear, that Rav is no longer going to be relevant to you because you're going to be in shamto. You're going to be put into excommunication, and it's an expression or a way to say that I'm going to pull Rav out of your ear, meaning that I'm going to remove Rav as a factor in this case because you're going to be put into excommunication. So he's trying to put him in his place and make him realize that there was no favoritism here in terms of the adjudication, and therefore he better pay attention or he better act appropriately in the case. Now the Gemara here is going to darshan the psukim in Devarim, this Aleph, this week's Parsha. And over there Moshe explains what he did with the judges, and he said that I can't handle you guys all alone, and therefore I needed to bring in others to help me. And there it says, when Moshe brings in these new individuals to help him out, it says, Vatzaved shoftechem beitahi lemor, Shamoa ben achechem, ushvatetem tzedek ben ish uben achiv uben gero, which is what we saw in yesterday's daf. Those are the qualities or the requirements that a judge must have in his adjudication of cases, which is that he can't favor any of the parties and that he has to deal equitably in the situations. And then, lo takiru panim b'mishpat, you cannot favor any party in the adjudication. Kekaton kegadol tishma'un, that you have to listen or hear the small and the big together. The Gemara will explain that in 1 second. Lo taguru mipnei ish, you can't be afraid of anyone. And again, we saw that 2 days ago, daf, as well as here, we're going to see it in a moment. Ki ha'mishpat b'alukim ho, because there's nobody to fear except God. That's the only one that you represent, and that's the only truth that you need to worry about. Anything that is too difficult for you, you'll bring to me, ushmatif, and then I'll listen to it, and I will deal with it. And then I commanded you at that time all the things that you needed to do. So now the Gemara is going to go through these psukim in which Moshe Rabbeinu is explaining the job description as well as the job qualifications of the judge to explain to us what are these requirements. Kikaton kigadol tishma'un. Amar Reish Lakish, shei chaviv alecha din shel puta, kedin shel mea maneh. So that you'll be beloved to you a case about one pruta versus a case about 100 zuz. Obviously, one is a huge case, and one of them is a case about a minimal amount of money. Where it says the Mahilchata, what's the question over here? If you're saying to look into the matter and give a proper psakalocha, pshita, what's the other choice? Of course, in any situation, you have to look into the case properly, and you have to adjudicate fairly. The amount of money involved in the case should not be the factor in whether you look into it or a factor as to what your psak is. So obviously that can't be what's swaying the individual over here. Ela lakdume. Question is, precedence. Who goes first? In the case where you have a case of a pruta that came before you, and then all of a sudden a big money case comes in, you would think maybe you should give precedence to the big money case. They should go first. That's what it says. Kekaton kegado. Can't show favoritism in terms of the size of the case. You have to deal with the case that came in first, and that's the pruta case, and then afterwards, deal with the case that is a larger sum of money. Over here, the Marsha asks, what's the question again? If you're already adjudicating a case, why should you interrupt the case to deal with another case? That can't really be the explanation. And therefore, he says it has to do with the compensation that a judge may be entitled to. A judge is entitled to skar b'teila d'muchach. If it's something that's obvious, the amount that he's giving up, or the foregone income that he's going to have, he's allowed to claim that. So there are reasons why in a larger sum of money case that might be more obvious. The first thing is that there's enough money there to make a difference. Obviously, in a small pruta case, if he's going to make a claim for compensation, first of all, there's not much money in the case. To ask for compensation would be a little bit ludicrous if the compensation is going to be more than the value of the case. In addition, it might reduce the value of the case below a pruta, and we don't adjudicate cases that are less than a pruta. For that reason, he might be want to move the larger sum case forward because then he actually can get paid for it. And that's what the Marsha says. The Gemara is saying over here, you don't have a right to do that. Even though you might be compensated for that case, in this case you're going to have to do pro bono. Nevertheless, you got to do this case first because this case came in first and you don't have a right to favor larger sum cases over the smaller sum cases. Lo taguru ipneish. Over here, it's questionable whether this belongs here or not. It might depend on the girsa that you had back on Daf Vov Amud Bet, which is Amar Rav Chanan, Al tachnis devarecha mipnei ish. You shouldn't hold back your words because of anyone else. So now, we saw this back on Vov Amud Bet with regards to the ani, that when it comes to a student that is sitting in front of his Rebbe, how do we know that the student shouldn't be silent, that he shouldn't stand by when the Ani's case is going against him? And there it says, Lo tagur mipneish. And then it says, Rabbi Chanin Omer, Al tichnich devarecha mipneish. So now, the question there is whether that's a statement that's supportive of the previous statement, or it's a totally independent statement. Over there you can see the Rashal says, Ve'amar Rabbi Chanin. So that Rabbi Chanan added in, meaning that he was explaining the previous statement. How do you know Lo tagur mipneish means that you don't hold back your words in that case? So that would be because it says lo taguru mipneish. The word taguru over there means lo tachnis devarecha. Don't gather in your words. Don't withhold your words in front of anyone. And based on that, his statement would be then an addition to what was said over there, and then we wouldn't bring them independently over here. On the other hand, if you think that's a different statement than what the Gemara made over there, I mean, the Gemara made a statement about the ani, and then separately makes a statement, al tachnis devarecha mipneish, means that you shouldn't be afraid of anyone. And don't worry about what you say, or don't worry about your psak. And so therefore, you would then see this as an independent statement that might fit over here, which is that al tachnis devarecha mipneish, similar to the katon and kadol, don't be afraid of giving up psak alocha. Don't be afraid of the big guys, the little guys, whoever can cause you problems, you should say whatever the truth is in these cases and don't be fearful of the repercussions of what you're saying because you know that you're doing the right thing. So over here, you can see it's in parentheses where the marshal takes it out, where there are those that leave it in, depending on whether that was a continuation of that previous statement, or here it's an independent statement. If it's an independent statement, you can see it have meaningfulness over here, which is don't be afraid. Over there, the Dalia Tosafot say that being afraid is not an issue by a sheer virush, by a rich person and a poor person. Rather, that's the reinterpretation that Rabbi Chanan or Rabbi Chanin is giving over here, which is Al Tachnis Deberchu Mipnei Ish, means don't hold back. Not that you're fearful, but don't hold back when it comes to the Talmid Bifnei Rabo. But that means that it's not a general statement for Shoftim, or a general statement about a case of adjudication that you shouldn't be afraid of. So depending on whether you have the Vav back on Vav Amud Bet, would determine whether it fits in here or it's in parentheses. Ki Amishpat Elokim Hu, that adjudication or the outcome is in the hands of God, which means that you are trying to reach a truth that reaches the truth that God would have given in this case, the true Torah law. So Amar Rav Chama b'Rabbi Chanina Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, lo dayan l'rishayim shenotim mizeh mamon v'notim lezeh shelo kidin. It's not enough that these evil judges, we'll call them unqualified judges, judges who do not have a right to be adjudicating cases, not only do they cause problems because they pervert the outcome and they cause the money to be moved from the person who it really belongs to, the person it doesn't belong to, but now they bother me or they cause me all the trouble of having to return the money to its rightful owner. That's what it means, because ultimately, God's got to ensure that justice prevails. So either justice prevails because the judge does the just thing, and he does what God would have wanted, and that's, again, we spoke about that in the introduction to the Masechta, that the word Elohim is used to describe the judge, just like it's used to describe God. And the judge, in a sense, is trying to align his thought and his psak with what God would have wanted and to reach that emet, that truth. But if he doesn't do it, then he leaves it in God's hands to rectify it. So if he perverts that justice, then God not only has to deal with this Russia who messed things up, but now he's got to go and rectify it. God's got to now intervene and get things righted again. And so that's what God says, Ki meshpat l'lukim hu, lo tagru mipnei ish, don't be afraid of anybody, do the right thing and speak the truth and come to just outcomes, because that way I don't have to intervene. Because if you don't do that, then I'm going to be on the hook to intervene and ensure that there is a just outcome. But davar esher yikshe mikem, the thing that is too difficult for you, Moshe says, you'll bring to me. Amar Rav Chanina, v'item Rav Hoshaya, al davar zeh ne'enash Moshe. Moshe was punished for saying this. Shenemar v'yakrev Moshe mishpatan lifnei Hashem. So this is last week's parsha and this week's parsha. Over here, they're claiming that Moshe Rabbeinu was punished over here because he said that the things that are too difficult, you should bring to me. Instead of saying that they should bring them to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or that he will bring them to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe, in a sense, takes credit as if I'll be the one. He should have said, Rashi says, She'elomar tikuvun lifnei Hashchina. We'll bring them to God. We'll ask God what the answer is, or we'll try to figure out the situation. Moshe over here takes credit and says, you know what, if it's too hard, just come to me. So now, Rabbi Yoshaya says he gets punished for that, because in the case of Benot Zalavchad, Moshe does not know the answer. They bring their question before Moshe, and Moshe is unable to answer them. Elohim Kain, he goes to God, and he asks God what the answer is or what the situation is. In essence, it does what he should have said, which is it's not coming to him and asking him, but rather he's going to go to God. So now they create a scenario or a situation which forces Moshe to go to God to ask, that proves what should have been said originally. Mativ la Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, mitiv v'ashmi achem. Moshe over there doesn't say that you'll come to me and then I will tell you, I will let you know what the answer is. Ush mativ k'tiv. He says, and I will listen. I will hear. That means, igamirna gamirna. If I know it, if I learned it already, then I know it and I'll tell you. Below, azilna v'gamirna. If not, I'm going to go speak to God and get the answer. So ush mativ is a statement by Moshe that he'll be receptive to an answer. Receptive to an answer either because he knows the answer, or that he needs to get the answer from God. So it doesn't seem to indicate what Rav Hoshaya is saying, and therefore Rav Nachum Yitzchak thinks that's not the right way to interpret this. Elekei d'Tanya, but rather like the bright that we saw in Baba Batra, Ruuya Parshat Nachalot Shetikate Vayedei Moshe Rabbeinu. The truth is that Parshat Nachalot, like any other parshiot in the Torah, should have been given in the name of Moshe Rabbeinu. God spoke to Moshe, and Moshe speaks to the people. Elu shezachu benot tzavchad v'nichtav hayadan. But the benot tzavchad, because of their meritorious actions, were granted that special recognition that the parshia was written in their name. And the similar thing, ruya haita parshat mikoshesh tikatev v'yadei Moshe Rabbeinu. Similarly, the woodchopper in the midbar, that parshia about what the punishment or the appropriate punishment for that individual was, should have been again said over in the name of Moshe. Ela shenitchayev mekoshesh v'nichtava yado. But rather that the mekoshesh enitzim forced the issue, and he became culpable for his actions, and therefore it's written in his name. And that's what we also know that lamedcha shemegagalim chova yadei chayav. That's why we put the negative, the culpability, liability associated the one that's already liable or culpable. And the merits to the ones that are meritorious. So the benot tzavchad, who were doing something that was meritorious, they were tzidkaniot, and therefore, when it came to the parshia that was associated with their situation, the parshia said over in their name, megagalim zchut edei zakai. When it came to the mekoshesh etzim, again, there, the punishment that was to be meted out to him is caused or triggered by his action, and here he is a person who's going to be put to death for his violation of the Shabbat, and therefore this negative precept, which is the punishment that's going to be associated with the action that he took, is associated with his name. And so that concept plays out also with regards to Tisha B'Av. Now we're beginning the 9 days. The Mishnah tells us in Ta'anit that 5 things, Iru Davotenu on Tisha B'Av, and that is that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And the Gemara says, how do you know that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av? And the Gemara uses the same terminology here, Megaglim Chova Yedei Chayav, that it was already a day that was inauspicious, and the Churban HaBayit HaSheni was around this time. So if we know it's around this time, and we have this day that's already marked as an inauspicious day, then Megaglim Chuva Ayadei Chayav. We put the negative next event, we associate it with this particular day, and that's a historical thing that happens over and over again, where we find negative events or terrible tragedies that were around the area of Tisha B'Av, that automatically we just assign them the day of Tisha B'Av because of this concept of Megalgalim Chuva Ayadei Chayav. The other interesting thing is, despite the fact that the Gemara over here rejects the explanation that Moshe was wrong in this case, and that what he said was inappropriate, and therefore he's punished for it, that was Rabbi Oshaya's view. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak rejects that, and the Gemara concludes, seemingly otherwise, despite that fact, Rashi brings Rabbi Oshaya's explanation of the Pasuk in his commentary on Chumash, and says, V'davar she'ikshem ikem tikuvun elai bishmativ, Rashi over there brings that Moshe was punished for saying such a thing. And then the pasuk continues, "Vatzevet shoftechem beitahi leimor shemoa ben achachem ushvatetem tzedek ben ish uben achiv uben gero." So Gemara says, "Vatzevet shoftechem beitahi uchtiv." It also says, "Vatzevet chem beitahi," which is so the pasuk before the one we just read was "Vatzevet shoftechem beitahi leimor," and then the subsequent pasuk, the one we just read before, was "Vatzevet chem beitahi." There's one sivui to the shoftim, and one tzivui to etchem, to Bnei Yisrael. And the Gemara comments on that. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Samlai, Azara Letzibur, Shedei Emat Dayan Alehem. That there's now an imperative to the tzibur that the fear of the judge be placed upon them, that they accept the rulings of the judge, and they treat the judge with the proper respect and proper fear, and that Mora Rabbach Kemora Shabayim, that your fear of your Rebbe and the leaders of the generation should be like that of Mora Shemaim. And again, especially what we've seen, that the word Elohim is used to describe a judge, which is also the same word, Elohim, that is used to describe God. And so in that vein, it's only appropriate that the Emav, the Dayan, should be the same as Emat Shemaim. And just like you have the fear of God, so too, you have to have the fear of the Dayan upon you. Vazara la Dayan, she's bullet at Tzibur. And the other tzivoy to the shoftim is that the shoftim have to be able to deal with the people. That they have to be patient, and they have to deal properly with the people. Ad kama. How far does that go? I mean, how much patience and how much do we expect of the dayan with dealing with the people? Amar Rabbi Chanan, Vitem Rabbi Shabtai. The words that Moshe Rabbeinu says in Parshat Balotcha when he's asking God for help and for additional individuals to help him share the burden, because there he says, Kashe Yisrael Mein Et Ayunek. That Moshe describes how he is carrying this nation like a nurse takes care of the young suckling, and that is to deal with them in a gentle and nurturing manner. And so that's a very high standard on both sides. It's a high standard on the people in terms of their requirement of how to treat the judge, Kimura Shamayim. And the other way around, it's a high standard on the judge about his patience and his ability to deal with the difficulties of the people, that it goes as far as that natural relationship between a nurse and a baby, so too, they're going to have to treat the Bnei Yisrael in that manner and take care of them in that manner. Now, Ketiv, it says at the end of Sefer Dvarim, in Parshat Vayelech, Vayikra Moshe Yoshua, Vayomer Elav Lehnei Kol Yisrael, Chazak Ve'ematz, Ki Ata Tavo Et Ha'am Hazeh La'aretz, Asher Nishba Hashem La'avotam, Vatetahem, Va'ata Tanchilena Otam. And later on, in the same parak over there, it says, Vayichtov Moshe Et Hashira Hazot Vayomahu, Vayilamdad Bnei Yisrael, Vayitzav Et Yoshua Binun Vayomer, Chazak Ve'ematz, Ki Ata Tavi Et Bnei Yisrael La'aretz, Asher Nishbati Lehem, Vanochi Yeimach. So here the Gemara contrasts the case where Moshe in the first case says, Ki Ata Tavo, versus in the latter case where he says, Ki Ata Tavi. And we'll also note later on that one of them is Moshe Rabbeinu speaking, and the other one is Moshe Rabbeinu quoting a Kodesh Baruch Hu's statement to Yoshua Binun. So both cases it's referencing to Yoshua Binun about his charge to take the people into Eretz Yisrael. And as Rashi notes over here, Ki Ata Tavo makes it sound like you're amongst those that are going in. You will go with them, means hand in hand with them, on a peer level with them. But Ki Ata Tavi means that you will bring, means that you're in a position of leadership, or you're at the forefront. And so here, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Lo Moshe Yoshua, when Moshe is speaking to Yoshua, he says, Ata Vazakini Mishibidor Imahem, that you, along with the elders of the generation, are going to take care of the nation, you're going to bring the nation in. I mean, that there'll be a shared burden of leadership, and that you, Yoshua, along with the Zekenim, will bring the people in. Ki Ata Tavo Et Bnei Yisrael is spoken by Moshe Rabbeinu, because over there it says that Ki Ata Tavo, the La'aretz Asher Nishba Hashem, the land that God promised. So that's Moshe Rabbeinu speaking, because he's speaking about God promised the land. And in the Pasuk, later on in the Dvarim, it says, El ha'aretz asher nishbati la'avotechem, to the land that I promised to your forefathers in the first person. So there is Kadosh Baruch Hu speaking. So in the first case, Moshe says, it's a shared burden of leadership, it's you and the Zekenim. And to that, Kadosh Baruch Hu says later on in Dvarim, Amar lo ha'Kadosh Baruch Hu, Tol makel v'hachal kadkudam. You don't have to be so nice, you take your staff and you smack them on the forehead and you tell them what to do. Meaning that you're in charge. And you've got to tell the people how to act. You've got to tell the people what to do. It's not this rule by consensus. It's not this idea that everybody is going to have their say in the matter. You're the leader. And you've got to set the standard. And you've got to lead the people in a strong manner. Devar achad ledor, ve'ein shnei devarim ledor. Meaning one leader for a generation and not two leaders for a generation. Moshe says to Yoshua, it's going to be you and the Zekenim. And then Hashem responds, it's not going to be you and the Zekenim, it's going to be you. Because there's only one leader per generation, and Yoshua, you're the leader, and therefore you're ultimately the one responsible. Comes with both sides of that, that you will be the leader and you dictate, but it also means you're the one who's responsible. But there is only a single leader, it's not a shared leadership that Moshe Rabbeinu was describing. Tana, we have a braita that says, Zimun Bishlosha, that Zimun requires three. My Zimun. What is the Zimun that we're speaking about here? Ilemar Birkat Zimun. If you say we're talking about benching and having a Zimun of benching, that there's a requirement of three, Vahatanya. We have a braita that says Zimun. Ubirkat Zimun Bishlosha. So that seems to indicate that there are two different things. There's Zimun and there's Birkut Zimun. They both require three, but they're different things. V'chitei Mipruche Kamefarish. my zimun, birkat zimun, if you say that breita, what it's doing is saying to you, zimun, colon, what is zimun? Birkat zimun, bishlosha, that requires three. So maybe that's how you'll say to explain the breita. Vatanya, if an other breita makes it clear that that's not the way to read it, because it says, zimun bishlosha, birkat zimun bishlosha. So if it was perushe kameforish, then the word shlosha should not appear twice, because there's only one shlosha to speak about. There's zimun, colon, birkat zimun, bishlosha. In fact, now they mention zimun bishlosha and birkut zimun bishlosha. That makes it clear that these are two different issues completely. Birkat zimun, we know what that is. That's benching. That's the requirement, minimum requirement of three individuals in order to have zimun. Elamai zimun. So then what is the zimun by itself? What does that mean over here? Azmun eladin. It is a subpoena to come to court. It's when the court demands that you show up in court. They send out their messenger, and that messenger has to come with the word of the three dayanim. He has to come representing the court as a whole, and not any single judge or single individual. Kihada marova, hana beitlata dayone diatve, va'aza shlicha de beidina. If you have these three judges that are sitting in the court, and then the shliach beitin, the sheriff of the beitin, goes out, va'amar mipuma dachad, and he says in the name of one of the judges that you are subpoenaed, that we demand that you show up in court, lo amar klum. That is not binding on the party. He doesn't have to show up in court. Adamar mishmei dekulu. Until he says it over in the name of all the judges. I mean, it has to be an invitation of the court, or a demand for presence of the court, and not of any single individual. And that's what it means, zimun bishlosha. Now, hani milei below yom adedina. That's only true when it's not a normal day of the court sitting. But on the day when the court sits, then there's no issue. So again, the Biyom HaDedina is Mondays and Thursdays, when from the time of Ezra they established that the courts would sit every Monday and Thursday. So if the Shliach Beit Din shows up on a Monday and Thursday and invites you to be in the court by this individual, it's clear we're talking about the court as a whole, because that's the day that everybody knows that the court is in session. So if the court's in session, you get an invitation, or really a subpoena to show up in the court, doesn't matter that's quoted in the name of one of the judges, it's clear that they're asking you to come on the day that the court's in session. But if this happens on a day when the court is not in session, then it needs to be articulated that the Shliach Beit Din is coming in the name of the Beit Din and not in the name of any single judge to subpoena the individual, ask them to show up in the court. Right now, we discussed all the first section of the Mishnah, now we're up to the case of Motzi Shemra in the Mishnah. So there it's Shlumik Eva V'chule. Sholach le Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. Rav Nachman bar Yisra, queries of Rav Nachman bar Yaakov. Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu. Please teach me, Rabbi. Dine knasot v'kama. When it comes to issues of fines, how many individuals have to be in the court in order to impose a fine on the individual? So when it says, Maikim Mibayle, what's the question? Hanan Tnan, Bishlosha. Didn't our Mishnah say explicitly that it's with three? We had a whole list of knasot, all these fines, and every one of them said shlosha, that you need three judges. Ela yachid mumche kamibayle. He's asking a question as to whether a single individual who has smicha would be sufficient in this case to adjudicate. Dain dine knasot. Is he able to adjudicate a case of fines? Olo, or maybe not. Remember, we've already seen that dine mamonot b'shlosha, the dine mamonot require three, but then we also said that yachid mumche l'rabim, that he could sit alone and adjudicate the case. So the question is, by knasot, does the same thing apply? The main requirement is to have three, but now, is it possible that you can have yachid mumche do it in place of those three? Amalei tenitua. It says that's our Mishnah. Tashlumei kefil, tashlumei arbar b'chamisha b'shlosha. Then when it comes to the payment of kefil and four or five times, these are all knasot, b'shlosha, you require three. My shlosha. When the Mishnah says you require three, what does that mean? If you're saying you just need three judges, doesn't matter if they have smicha, doesn't matter who they are. Hamar avua davuch. Didn't your father's father say mishmei derav? In the name of Rav, afilu asara vehine jotot. Even if you have 10 judges and they're all lay people, psulim the dine knasot. They're disqualified from dealing with issues of knasot, issues of fines. So we see here that hejotot, lay people, cannot adjudicate cases of knasot. While they may be valid in cases of dine memonot, or certain cases of dine memonot, when it comes to dine knasot, hedyotot are completely disqualified. So the Mishnah can't be saying when it says three, that it means three regular judges. The three, it must mean, is Ela Mumchim. Kamar Shlosha. It must mean that they're talking about people with smicha, expert judges that are going to adjudicate the case. That's the requirement by Knesot. And it says three. So now you see that there's a requirement not only for three, but three Mumchim, and that's what the Mishnah is demanding. Three was a given. The question was now, do they have to be Mumchim? And now we say it has to be three Mumchim. So now you know that even when you have a Mumchim, even when you have an expert, you still have that minimum requirement of three. And that tells us that by Knesot, there is this requirement of three judges, but not only three judges that are smuchim, and that are expert judges that have smicha, which is going to present the problem for us later on when there's only smicha in Eretz Yisrael, and they don't have the smicha in Bavel. How do the people in Bavel adjudicate these cases that seemingly require shlosha mumchim? Now, in terms of the response of Rav Nachman bar Yaakov to Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Avu adu avuch, your father's father, well, Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista's father was obviously Rav Chista, and now it's saying the father of Rav Chista. Rav Chista is a Talmid of Rav, but he's also a Talmid of some of the Talmidim of Rav. So it would make sense in terms of generationally that Rav Chista's father would have been someone who was close to Rav and might have passed on the learning to Rav. It's also possible that it's referencing to Rav Chista's father-in-law. Rav Chista's father-in-law was Rav Chanan bar Rava. And Rav Chanan bar Rava was one of the Talmidim of Rav, one of the Talmidim of Chokim of Rav. And so therefore it really could have been Avua d'Imech, the father of your mother, which was means that Rav Chista's father-in-law, who was the individual they were speaking about here, just they wrote it Avua d'Avuch, they just wrote your grandfather, but it was the grandfather from the maternal side and not from the paternal side. But either way, this was the memory that they had from Rav, and in that they prove that the answer to his question about Yochin Mumche is in the negative, which is that you require three Mumchim and a single Mumche would not be enough by Knesot. Then the Mishnah moves on to discuss the issue of Motzi Shemra, and over there we had a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Rabbi Meir says that it's sufficient with three, and Chachamim or me, Motzi Shemra, Besrim B'Shlosha. And the Chachamim over there said you require a minimum of 23, because of the issue of Dinei Nefashot. Where it says, V'chi yesh bo Dinei Nefashot, my hobby. Just because it has matters that can lead to capital punishment, why does it matter? Why do you need 23 in this case? The way that Rashi says the question is being phrased is, it's fine that this case could end up as a capital case, but right now it's not a capital case. And as long as it's not a capital case, why do you require 23? Now, of course, Rabbi Meir will agree that if it's a capital case, you require 23. The question is now, the Chachamim, why when it's not a capital case, why are they requiring 23? Even if it could lead to a capital case, we'll deal with it. Once it becomes a capital case, we'll deal with it. But right now it's a monetary case. Why not leave it as three? So now we have here, today's daf will go through four or five of the answers, and it will go into tomorrow's daf, we'll reach about six answers to this question that's being posed by the Gemara here, trying to explain the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. So Amar Ula, Ula is the first of those, which is, B'choshim l'laz kamiflege. They're arguing about whether we worry about laz. Rabbi Meir savar, ain choshim l'laz. Rabbi Meir says, we don't worry about it. Rabbanan savre, choshim l'laz. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe that we are Choshesh Laz. What this Laz is somewhat cryptic. And here you have a machlok between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to what the meaning of Laz is over here. Rashi claims that Laz is the possibility that you will bring a deem out of the woodwork. Which is here you have a monetary case. And here this is also a controversial, meaning that machlok between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam, as to what the claim is in the case. What is the monetary matter that's being adjudicated? So Rashi claims that the monetary matter being adjudicated over here is the husband making a claim that he no longer owes this woman her ketubah because she had a previous affair. She was not a betulah when he married her, and so therefore she's not entitled to a ketubah of a betulah. And so what the husband is making a claim is that we should rip up her ketubah, or we should downgrade her ketubah because she clearly was not a betulah. That's what the monetary case is according to Rashi. So Rashi says they bring this monetary case. The question of Choshin Laz is, now that the husband is bringing this case against his wife, saying that she was unfaithful before they got married, will that bring other edim out of the woodwork that will come and testify to the fact that not only was she not a betulah, but she also had this affair or was unfaithful during the time that she was in Arusa, which would then subject her to the death penalty or to make it into a capital case. So Rashi claims that the laws over here is that once this becomes a public issue, will that bring out now edim that will help to establish a capital case, not just a monetary case. So for Rashi, the first step is the monetary case is the husband making a claim against a woman or her father for the ketubah. And then the laws is the possibility that that will be upgraded to a capital case because now edim will come out of the woodwork, and that's the laws that we're worried about. The Balei HaTosafot take issue with Rashi on a number of fronts. First of all is the word laws. The word laws in general means that we worry about sheker, lies. Laws doesn't usually mean that we worry about word getting out and the new edim showing up. Laws means that we worry about people lying or being in a problematic circumstance. That's laws that we would speak about in general. That's number one. Number two is, why does the husband have any claim against the wife? He's not the one who has to pay the ketubah unless he divorces the woman. If he divorces the woman, then you could speak about the claim, but then he'd again be the defendant. The claimant over here is the woman who wants her ketubah paid out. So she'd be the one who asks for the payment, and then the husband would be the defendant to say no. To be the toveya, to be the claimant over here, the husband that he's asking for the 100 zuz, he's not entitled to any money. He is just doesn't have to pay out money, or just defend against paying out money. He's not a toveya, he's not a claimant in this case. That's the second problem that they have with this Rashi. In addition, we're going to get next to Mood, the Gemara is going to specifically say, tiva'o mamon, that there was a claim made by the Baal. Well, if the claim is made by the Baal, the claim Baal has no claim over here. The claim would not have been made by a Baal, it would have been made by the other side for monetary compensation. The other thing is, the Balei HaTosafot say, what is this doing in a grouping? In the Mishnah, it's grouped with Ones, Mifateh, and Motzi Shemra. Well, what's the common denominator between Ones, Mifateh, and Motzi Shemra? According to Rashi, the fact that the husband's asking for the ketubah to be taken away, what does it have anything to do with Ones and Mifateh? For all these reasons, plus more, the Balei HaTosafot say that Rashi's explanation here is incorrect, and the claimant over here is not the husband, but rather the father of the woman. And the father over here is making a claim for his 100 zuz at Maneh that he's entitled to for the Motzi Shemra, for the maligning of his daughter by this individual improperly. There's a knas, there's a fine of Meazuz, Meashekel Kesef, that he has to pay. And that's what the common denominator is with Ones and Mifateh. Ones and Mifateh are also knasot that are paid, the seducer and the rapist. They have to pay the 50 shekel kesef, and here the Motzi Shemra pays 100 shekel kesef. Now we found the common denominator between them. In addition, that'll explain why there's a claimant over here. The claimant is the father. He's making a claim for monetary payment for this knas to be paid out to him. That's why we're speaking about a claimant and not a defendant over here. In addition, the laws that we're speaking about over here is that we're worried now that other edim will show up in the case. And those other edim that show up in the case will then bring it up to a capital case. The problem with that is not the edim, but it's the judges. The laws is going to be spoken about these judges who began the case and were adjudicated the three. And then all of a sudden we add on 20 judges onto the case. So the laws is not going to be about the edim that come in, but about the judges that are sitting in the case. Why couldn't these three judges deal with it? Why do we have to add on 20 judges on top of them? Were they incompetent? Were they not able to deal with the issue? And so therefore, the addition of these judges in a case that is all of a sudden raised to a capital case would then cast aspersions on the original judges. So that's the way that the Balei HaTosafot, it's really Rabbeinu Tam, explains this Gemara. The laws is not the laws of what we call the other edim coming in. The laws is if the case becomes a capital case, and the judges were going to be looked upon negatively because they couldn't adjudicate the case. They had to bring in extra judges. As well as that the claimant over here is the father and not the Baal. And you can see a similar sentiment within the Rabbeinu Hanana where he says, Komari meshvu shloshah ledin ala Baal veonsho uli yasro. So it's clear here that the claimant originally or up front is the father making a claim against the husband. And similar to the Balei HaTosafot, he explains that the laws is, the reason they added on these 20 judges here to the first three is because the first three didn't know what they were doing. And that will cause aspersions on those first three, and that's what the laws is over here. So Rabbeinu Hanano echoes a similar way to read the Gemara as the Rabbeinu Tam. Now Rashi himself acknowledges that there was such an explanation of the Gemara on the Amud Bet, and he says that about that explanation, so some people explain it this way, it's impossible to say that. The only way that the husband becomes chayav for maligning this woman by falsely accusing her of being unfaithful and not being a betulah is in a case where he brings edim, and then those edim end up being muzam, that they end up having edim zomim come and say, imanu aitem, or you couldn't be there, you were thus on such and such a day, and they disqualify the edim that the husband brought. In that case, the husband is chayav. Otherwise, why would the husband be chayav for motzi shemra? So Rashi says, based on that, there's no way you can have it that the husband is chayav over here. The Rabbeinu Tam is mechadesh something, which even the Bali Tosavot himself is not willing to accept later on, but the Rabbeinu Tam says over here, mefresh Rabbeinu Tam, the kulish maita ayrei linyan kufslaim. The whole sugi is talking about the kufslaim as we explained before. Sha'av tovei labal. Mekoshishin the laz, and what we're about here is the laz is hainu laz hadayanim. So we're worried about it. Why? Kagon. She'evia bal edim shizinta. That the Baal brought edim that said that this woman had an affair or was unfaithful. V'chuchushu. And then there were other edim who come in and contradicted them. The mechayeva bal hashta kufslaim. There the Baal is chayav. So even though you have edut mucheshet, even though you have a stalemate amongst the edim, the Rabbeinu Tam claims over here that still is mechayev the Baal. In that instance, the husband's going to have to pay the 100 zuz for maligning the woman because his edim didn't pan out. Even though it's just 2 against 2, and it's just a contradiction. We're not talking about hazama, which eliminates them completely. So we're talking about a contradiction over there. The Rabbeinu Tam says the husband's on the hook for the money in that situation. The Bali et Tosafot later on say that Avanira Dochak, Mashapirish Rabbeinu Tam, the Khashab Loha Zama Mechayev Kuslaim, that just contradictory testimony is enough to obligate the husband to pay out the fine, and not just in a case of Hazama. But Tsarich Lomar, the Rabbeinu Tam, and what you have to say Rabbeinu Tam is Shehi Muteret the Bala, Shelo Kibnu Edutan, Oshekushu, that the woman is muteret to remain with her husband, in a case where either they were found not to have a dud that survived drisha v'chakira, or they were contradicted, dilav hochi, if it wasn't for that, heichi mechayev kufslaim, then it would not be chayev of 100 zuz. Halo karina bevelotia lisha. The other part of the punishment is not only does he have to pay out 100 zuz, he's got to keep this woman for the rest of his life. So there we have a requirement that velotia lisha. It has to be a woman who he can keep for the rest of his life. Well, if we believe the edim and edim uchesheshet enough to say that she's asura lebala, then he can't be a loti elisha. So what he says from there is that it's clear that you must believe that the edim uchesheshet, the contradicting testimony, does not disqualify the woman from remaining with this individual, with this man. And since she now can remain with him, he's now obligated to pay the money because he maligned her, and now he can keep her as a wife. Ve'yeshli mod mikan, the Bali Tosafot say, based on that, you have to learn from this. Diatu edim, vamru eshet ploni, zinta. The edim come along and say, the wife of so-and-so was unfaithful. She had an extramarital affair. The baya drisha v'chakira lo osra bala. You have to check these edim out carefully before we disqualify her from being with her husband. Visvaru, and it's logical. Delo garam gzilot v'chavalot. How's any worse than a case of gzilot v'chavalot? And then he brings over here from the Rosh Mishantz, that in Yerushalmi, there's actually a machlok d'amoraim along the lines of Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam over here, as to who the claimant is. Is the claimant the husband looking to get a reduction in ketubah? Or is the claimant over here the father looking to get compensated for the motzi shemra, for the malignment of his daughter? And so he says the Yerushalmi actually has amoraim to that effect, and that matches up with the machloket Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi over here as to what the sugya is speaking about. And again, we're going to see that along the way, there are difficulties in each one of their perushim. So Rava Amar, Kulei Alma Laz Lo Chashina. Rava says that everybody agrees that Laz is not a problem. We don't worry about, according to Rabbeinu Tam, the casting aspersions on the 3 judges that started out, we add on 20. For Rashi, that means that we don't worry about new edim showing up in this situation. We're worried about the kavod, the honor of the first judges, and we'll have to show how that's distinct from the issue of laws, according to the Rabbeinu Tam. They came to deal with a capital case. It's a case of Motzi Shemra. 23 judges gathered together in order to adjudicate the case. The Ivdor. And then they dispersed. They had to leave the case. The Balei Tosfot on the top of the next Amud give reasons why they might have to leave the case. There were emergencies that they were needed at. Whether that was an Egla Arufa that they needed to go take care of. Or the king was showing up and they had to go greet him. Whatever it is, something happened that caused the court to disperse. So in that situation, Amar Lahu, Dainu Li Mihi Dinim in Monot, and either, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, it's the father saying this, according to the Rashi, it's the Baal saying this, look, at least adjudicate for me the monetary matter. Okay, as far as the Dinim Fashot, that fell away, or that's not relevant anymore. But at least, deal with the monetary matter over here, let us adjudicate that. In that case, the question is, whether we're choshesh for the kavod arishonim. Now that the 20 left, and there are only 3 left, do we worry about the 20 that originally started the case? And we're going to say you can't finish out the case without all 23. Since 23 started, you got to finish with 23. Or do we say, no, now it's only a monetary matter, and you can drop off the other 20, and it will not be a begam in the kavod of the first 20 that sat in the case. So Rebbe says it's not a begam in their kavod. And therefore you can drop it down to 3 judges and it's fine. According to the Chachamim, that's a begam in the kavod of the original 20 judges that sat there. And it'd be inappropriate to continue the case with 3. You need to continue the case with the full 23. So now Meitevei, Gemara asks, the Chachamim omrim, the Chachamim say, Tiva'o mamon, if he makes a claim for monetary matters, bishlosha, then you require 3 judges. Tiva'o nifashot, if he makes a capital claim over here, I mean that, she was unfaithful while she was in Arusa and is deserving of the death penalty. That's Rim Vishlosha with 23. So over here you have an explicit Tosef that indicates the Chachamim believe that it depends on the claim that's being made here. If it's a monetary claim, then it's 3. If it is a capital claim, it is 23. Now, this is one of Tosavot's claims against Rashi, which is here it says Tivol. The Baal has no claim. He's a defendant. He wants to reduce something. So Tivo makes it sound like there's a real claimant over here, and that's why he says it's the father who's making the claim. So now Gemara says, Bishlamo the Rabba. So over here, we read the second answer as being with Rava, but based on what the Gemara is going to say now in the Balei Tosfot over here, this second answer really should have been in the name of Rabba. That's what it says here. Bishlamo the Rabba, Tivo Mamon, Tchila Bishlosha. If they start out the case as a monetary matter, no problem. Then you continue and you can adjudicate the case with 3. And then if they start the case as a capital case with 23, then if you're going to finish it off, according to the Chachamim, you have to finish it off with the full 23. You can't finish it off with 3, because Choshim the Kavod Rishonim. For Ula, it's a question, because Ula's explanation over here speaks about no matter how you start. According to Chachamim, you always start with 23, and that's how it continues. According to Rimei, you always start with 3. According to the Chachamim, where is there ever a case you're going to start with 3, according to Ula? According to Ula, from the outset, you start with 23 because of the possibility that you might reach a capital case. So Amar Rava, and that's why probably before the statement was Rabba who was arguing on Ula, and now you have Amar Rava coming to defense of Ula and says, Ani varisha b'chabura, I and the lion in the chabura, targumimna, and we explain this, or we're able to help Ula out in this case. Umanu, who's this? Ari in the Chabura. Rabchir Ba'avin. It was Rabchir Ba'avin who was one of the leading Talmidim in the Chabura. Hachal Mayaskinan. What's the case here? Shevia Baal Edim Shizinta. The husband brought Edim to testify the fact that she had an extramarital affair. Ve'av Edim. And then father brings Edim. Ve'hizimum le'de'abal. And they disqualified the Edim of the Baal. They didn't contradict them. They completely disqualified them by saying you couldn't have been there because you were with us. Valigavot mamon mi Baal. If the father now comes to make a claim for money from the husband, bishlosha, that has to be done with 3. Ubimakom nifashot, if it is a capital issue, besrim bishlosha. So first of all, here's one of Rashi's proofs to his position, which is, all of a sudden, here, the Gemara switches to speak about Balagavot Mamon. If the father is coming to make a monetary claim. That's this chiddush that Rova and Rav Chiya Ba'avin are introducing over here, is that the father is making a claim for money. That implies that until now, it was not the father who was making a claim for the money, but rather the way that we were explaining it was that it was the husband that was making the claim for the money. So this is one of Rashi's proofs that he's right about who the claimant was until now. Now, the situation over here is a situation in which you have Edei Hazama. In the cases of Edei Hazama, there is a very low likelihood, or we don't consider the possibility that new Edim will show up. When you're speaking about Edim and Edei Hachasha, contradictory Edim, you have one set of Edim saying yes, one of Edim saying no. So then the possibility of new Edim coming in is very high, because you have Edim on both sides, and it seems to be at least that there might be some truth to the statement that something happened over here, and therefore you might expect new Edim to come in. On the other hand, in a situation in which husband brought in Edim, and those Edim were disqualified, not because they were contradicted, because the Edim Zomimim came and disqualified them and saying, Imanu Aitem. And of course here, the case, as the Balei Tosafot point out here, that this Hazama has to take place before Gemar Adin, before the Beit Din came to a full conclusion, then they were Mezim, these Edim, because otherwise then you would be dealing with a capital case, because the Edim, Zomamim, would be subject to a death penalty like they were trying to impose on the woman. And so that's why the Balei Tosafot suggests over here that it was Kodim Gemar Din that they had this Hazama. On the other hand, there are other Rishonim, like the Ramban, who try to use this to come up with a compromised position somewhat sitting between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot. Ramban over here suggests that's a case where there is Hazama, because otherwise, like Rashi, he believed you can't get a chiyuv on the Baal to have to pay the knas without Hazama. But he says that it's a case of Hazama where the Edim who are coming to be Mezim say, we're only coming to be Mezim them, to disqualify them, but not to be Mechayev them Mita, which is a difficult answer, as the Meiri points out, because how do the Edim set that standard? But the Ramban uses that in order to try to thread between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam. And the Ramban does something similar by saying that the case here is where, as opposed to Rashi, who says we don't know about any Edim, and we're waiting for Edim to show up, and that's the Laz, the Ramban believes here that we already know that the husband has witnesses which he'll bring to the court, but the husband at this point only wants to deal with the monetary issues, and then separately deal with the capital case that comes afterwards. Both of those answers involve complexities, but in some ways they're trying to deal with the deficits in the Perushim of both Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam. But once we have determined that these Edim are Edei Sheker, that they're complete lying Edim, then it's very low likelihood that the Baal is going to show up with Edim. If he had to get Edim that lied, or even if he didn't know it, the Edim that he brought in were complete liars, then in that situation, the likelihood of new Edim coming in and corroborating the story is very low. So in that case, we're not going to worry about the fact that there's a possibility of new Edim coming in, and that will not require you then to raise it to a capital case. So that's how we're going to explain this position of the Chachamim, which is, if the father is coming to make a monetary claim in this situation, then in that case, he only needs three judges to deal with the case, because it's clearly going to be a monetary case. And even the Chachamim are going to agree, we're not worried about new people showing up over here, because the first set of Edim were found to be Shakranim. They're found to be complete liars. So therefore, if they come up for a monetary claim, the father is coming to make his claim for his Motzi Shemra over here, then we do it with three. If, on the other hand, it is a capital case, that's which is the normal case of Motzi Shemra, the normal situation, then we require 23. So in this one unusual situation in which the Edim of the Baal were Muzam, and therefore the father has a claim for his Knas of Motzi Shemra, in that case is clearly a monetary matter, and you only require three judges in that case. But in a case where there's simple contradiction between the sets of Edim, in that case, it will remain a case of 23, because there we do worry about the possibility that new Edim can show up in the circumstance or in this situation. And those new Edim then will require, according to Rashi, the possibility of upping it to a capital case, thereby causing the trial to move from a situation in which the Baal is making a claim over here to reduce his ketubah, elevating it now to a capital case. Whereas the Bali and Tosafot say that the possibility that this case will go from a claim of the father in a case of Eidut Mukheshet, whereby the father is now making a claim for the knas that he is owed. Not like the case of Rob over here, where it's a case of Eidut Muzemet, and that's why the father has a full proof monetary claim over here, and it's not going to be elevated to a capital case, but rather it's moving from an Eidut Mukheshet, where the father's making a claim for his knas, and then new Eidim might show up, which would then upgrade it to a capital case, by which now the woman is going to be on trial for an extramarital affair. Obviously, there would be no need to pay the knas by the husband anymore. And the laws that we're worried about is, according to the Bali Tosafot, the possibility that we'll have to add on judges, and that will cause laws on the original judges that adjudicated the case. So that's how we explain this brayta that says the Chachamim say Tiv'o Mamon Mishlosha, Tiv'o Nefashot Esrim Mishlosha. Esrim Mishlosha is your normal situation, your normal case. The case of Tiv'o Mamon Mishlosha is in an instance where we've already disqualified the Edim of the Baal, but that disqualification didn't come through contradiction, but rather through Hazama. And then we will no longer worry about new Edim showing up, since the first Edim were complete Shakranim. And so that's why the Chachamim say we can go on and go forward with three Dayanim in this case, because the father's claim for the Knas is in all likelihood going to remain a monetary matter, and that's why it's okay to use three according to Robo. Abayamar Dukuleyama Chashin and Lulas. Umishom Kvodan Shel Rishonim. So Abayi picks up on both on what Ula said as well as what Rabba said. And Abayi says that everybody agrees that we worry about Las. And that means even according to Rabbi Meir, that we would worry at the outset for new Edim to show up and we'd start out with 23. Umishom Kvodan Shel Rishonim. And we also worry about a situation in which you already started with 23, that we would have to complete it with 23. And over here, the Bali Tosafot make it clear that the two terminologies are not connected together, meaning that they're independent items. And that means that whether you believe that Choshishin Lelaz are not Choshishin Lelaz, you could then hold of Choshishin Lekvod Rishonim or Lo Choshishin Lekvod Rishonim. And even if you believe that everybody believes Choshishin Lelaz, does not compel you to believe that we are Choshish Lekvodan Shel Rishonim. It says, "Va'ein lefareish." Don't say that that's an automatic outcome in the Choshishin Lelaz. Koshkein the Choshishin Lekvod Shel Rishonim, because the two are not inextricably connected, and therefore, by making a statement over here, it's making two separate statements. One is Choshishin Lelaz, and number two is Choshishin Lekvod Rishonim, which would mean similar to what we saw already in the positions of Ula and Rabbo, that we worry about new Edim showing up. And we also worry about the fact that we started with 23, we don't downgrade it to 3. How come I ask you, but what's the machoket then between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir if we agree in all these situations? Go to Hatru Bastam, the case where they gave default Hatra'ah to the woman. Vaitanu Udatanya. And it's based on this machloket Tanaim that we have. So in this instance, they didn't warn the woman that her engaging in this activity could lead to a death penalty for her, because she's now engaging in an extramarital affair while she's in Arusa, that will result in her being punished by death. But they didn't explain to her, they didn't identify for her the type of death penalty that she would be subject to. And that's a machloket, as the Braita says, V'shar kol chayve mitot shibatorah, eim emitim otam ela be'idah ve'idim v'hatra'ah. When it comes to any of the other death penalties in the Torah, they are not put to death, except with an Eidah, and that means with 23 judges, the Eidim, witnesses testifying to the fact or to the act that took place, the Hatra'ah, and a warning about the fact that they face a death penalty for what they are doing. Vad, shudu shuchaya mita bebeitin. And that Hatra'ah involves indicating to him or making clear to him that if he goes through with this act, or in this case the woman goes through with the act, that they will be subject to a court-enforced death penalty. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ajiyodiyu b'ezim mitahu ne'erag. Rabbi Yehuda says you need to specify what is the death penalty that they would face and what is the punishment that we will face in this situation. It's not enough to say a death penalty, you have to say what type of death penalty the individual would face. And so therefore, the machloket here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is whether the Hatra'ah in this case is valid enough Hatra'ah that we would say that it's a capital case or not a capital case. If you believe that the generic Hatra'ah suffices, then we're dealing with a capital case over here, and that's why you would require 23. That's the position of the Chachamim. Rabbi Meir believes that that's not enough. that hatra'a requires not only you saying the generic statement that it is subject to a death penalty, but also giving which death penalty it is that this individual will be subject to. And so therefore, Rabbi Meir says it remains a monetary matter, a monetary case of three, because it's not going to be elevated to the status of a capital case, because you lack the hatra'a, which would allow it to become a capital case. Now, there are a couple of things to discuss over here. First of all, the issue of hatra'a, as Rashi and the Baal Tosfot note over here, comes out of the situation of mesit. We're talking about a mesit. This is someone who convinces other individuals to worship Avodah Zarah. And the Torah over there says that we treat this individual with tremendous severity. And there are a number of exceptions to the rules with regards to the procedures and protocol for indicting, prosecuting, and the reaching of decisions in a case about a mesit. A couple of things that we waive is, number one, that we are not mehapech b'schuyotav. We do not look favorably upon him. We don't look for meritorious sides in order to protect him from the death penalty. In addition, we are willing to hide witnesses and have someone, in a sense, entrap this individual trying to cause them to worship Avodah Zarah, because obviously this individual is not going around doing this in public. He's doing this quietly, and the only way for us to have witnesses is, in a sense, to set up a trap in which an individual will speak to him and then draw him into the conversation of convincing that individual to worship Avodah Zarah while we have a dim hidden and watching. And on that, Rashi says, Gabe mesit, koi fim bere mesit, rachman amar, lo tachmol velo techaseh, v'nerag beli hatra'a, aidei achmanat edim. What Rashi says over here is that there's no necessity for hatra'a with regards to a mesit. Just again, like we waive other normal procedures and protocols over here, so too with regards to hatra'a, there is no requirement of hatra'a by a mesit. And that's what the context of the statement over here is, vishar kol chayve mitot shebe Torah. Any other capital punishment in the Torah aside from mesit has these requirements, including one of the requirements is hatra'a. Tosafot disagrees and says that by mesit you also need hatra'a. Just the hatra'a will come in a different form than usual. The hatra'a over here is the hachmanat edim, which is the hiding of the edim to watch while somebody comes in and ensnares or entraps this individual by, in a sense, leading him into the conversation about being convinced of worshiping Avodah Zarah. And as part of that ploy, they need to say to the individual, Heyach, naniach, avinu shebishamayim, navo, detzim v'abanim. How could it be that we're going to leave our Father in heaven and go worship stones and sticks? So that is part of the quote-unquote hatra'a. So for Rashi, there's no hatra'a whatsoever by mesit. According to the Baal Tosfot, it's a modified hatra'a. It's a hatra'a that is not like the normal warning where you explicitly say to the individual, if you go through this act, you'll be subject to the following punishment. But rather, it's a hatra'a in the entrapment that we set up for him, that the conversation involves statements like, how are we going to leave God? How could you go and worship Avodah Zarah? So those types of statements are the equivalent of hatra'a in this case. And so that's what the Baal Tosfot say, that there is hatra'a over here. And his proof is that even though over here we have Eda, Edim, and hatra'a, so you would have thought that it says, by Shar Kol Chayve Mitot, this is the normal procedure protocol by all other death penalties with the exception of mesit. So the way Rashi looks at it is, well, the exception of mesit means mesit doesn't need hatra'a. The others do. The others require eda or two edot, an eda favorable and eda negative, and that gives the individuals the right or the necessity to speak up the zchut of the defendant. Whereas by a mesit, you don't have that requirement to speak up. But as the Baal Tosfot point out, that by both cases you need edim. You need witnesses. It's true, by the mesit, the witnesses are a little different because they're hidden witnesses. And there's a certain amount of entrapment over here. Nevertheless, there's still witnesses required, just like witnesses are required in the other instance. So what the Baal Tosfot show you is that not everything that's found with regards to Shar Chayvei Mitot is not true by mesit. So just like by the case of Edim, you need Edim in this case, and you need Edim for the mesit. So too, Baal Tosfot said you require Hatra'a for a normal capital case. You require Hatra'a also by the mesit. It'll just be a different type of Hatra'a, which is a Hatra'a that involves the entrapping individual to make certain statements that make it clear that this person is deviating from what otherwise would be normative requirements on them in terms of their faithfulness to God. And Abaye Tosvot will note over here that according to the Rabbeinu Tam, it makes sense why Abaye is compelled to say that Kulei Alma Chasheshin La'az, that everybody worries about La'az, because for the Rabbeinu Tam, the case always involves Hachashat Edim. And so therefore there's always a scenario in which the Edim are contradicted. And that's why we say Choshishin La'az, because then that automatically will graduate the case to a capital case or to 23, assuming that the Edut that is being brought has relevance to get it to that level of a capital case, because then we're Choshish that someone else will come in and corroborate the story of the first Edim. And then for Rashi, who doesn't think that there were Edim that came in, then what is the issue of Choshishin La'az? Even if everybody agreed, ain't Choshishin La'az, then according to Rashi, the machlok between the Rambanan and the Rebbe Meir could still exist, which is, are we choshesh for Edim that will come in and tell us this information? Are we choshesh that they'll come in and tell us information where there was no hatra'ah? Or are we not choshesh for those types of Edim? And even though Rashi over here says that Edim did show up and tell us what type of hatra'ah, that would be the thing that graduates it to a case of a capital case, whether the hatra'ah is good or not, nothing to do whether choshishin la'az or not choshishin la'az. And for that reason, the Balei Tosafot say that Rabbeinu Tam's explanation makes more sense here, because Abaye's saying that it must be a case of choshishin la'az infinitely favors the Rabbeinu Tam versus Rashi, where we should be indifferent about that. And now we have a fourth attempt at explaining this machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, which is Rapapa Amar, Hocha B'Isha Chavira Askinan. Here we're dealing with a woman who is well-educated. She's a chavera, which would qualify her to know the outcome in certain situations. And the machloket here between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Meir is premised on this other machloket. The Tanya, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Omer, chaver, ein tzarich hatra'ah. Someone who is knowledgeable does not require hatra'ah. V'ishlo nitna hatra'ah, el avchin ben shogeg demezid. The whole purpose of hatra'ah is to take the violation from a violation of shogeg, where the person can say, I thought it was mutar, or I didn't realize that it was asur, to a situation in which they know that they're intentionally doing this because the people are warning them that what they're doing is incorrect or improper. So that's true for someone who's not knowledgeable. But someone already has that knowledge, then you don't need hatra'ah, because in and of themselves they will know the difference between shogeg and mezid, and they know what's wrong. So in this situation, the argument between them is whether this lack of hatra'ah is going to ever develop into a capital case. The Rabbanan believe, like Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, that you don't need hatra'ah for chavirah, and therefore, even without hatra'ah, it could lead into a capital case. Whereas for Rabbi Meir, he will not subscribe to Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda and believe that hatra'ah is applicable even for individuals who know the difference between shogeg and mezid, or should know the difference and know what is asur. Nevertheless, there's still a requirement of hatra'ah, and the lack of hatra'ah over here means we don't have to worry about a capital case. And as Rashi notes over here, k'de Abaye nami svirle, the Rav Papa's position is built on Abaye, which is the choshishin la'az, ulich vodan shorishonim. So similar to Abaye, Rav Papa is assuming those two conclusions, which is we are choshishin la'az, and we're choshish the chvod rishonim. And the question here is, do we have the possibility of hatra'ah? Don't we have the possibility of hatra'ah when there was no edim to that hatra'ah, but the hatra'ah is self-evident because she is a chaviran, a knowledgeable woman? And so the case is where he shows up with edim in the beginning of the case, and the edim are going to testify about this woman's behavior, and they say up front that we didn't warn her, we didn't give her a hatra'ah because she's a chaviran. So according to Rabbi Meir, go to 3 edim, there's never going to be a capital case over here. The Chachamim go to 23, there is a possibility of a capital case, or the case turning out to being a capital case, because of the fact that the Hatra'ah, it's sufficient that she is a Chavirah. So according to Rashi, for both Rav Papa and Abaye, Ib Shelo Ba'u Edim, in a case where no Edim showed up, Kulei Alma Choshishim La'az, everybody worries about the fact that there may be the possibility of introducing new Edim, and therefore the Rabbanan would require you to have 23 up front. And again, if you started with a case of 23, we wouldn't let you reduce it down to a number of 3. The question arises in both of these instances where they bring in a deem that give you a specific type of hatra'ah. whether that's a hatra'ah that is not specific, or that's no hatra'ah at all, relying on the fact that the individual is a chaveira, what would be the situation? And that's the machlok between the Rebbeir and the Chachamim as to which side they subscribe to in those machlokot with regards to hatra'ah. The problem that you then have is what do you do with the braita up top of the amud, which is Chachamim Amrim, Tav'u Mamon Bishlosha, that in a case of a monetary case, then it's only with three. According to Rashi, how do you have a case like that when there are no edim, when the Baal is showing up and asking for his ketubah to be reduced, automatically the Chachamim will assume or necessitate 23. So where's the situation or the case where it would be three? So Rashi claims that both Abai and Rav Papa will subscribe to the answer that was given by Rava, and that the case there is a case where the husband brought edim, and then the father brought the edim that were mezim those edim. So, if that's the case, why doesn't it then still require 23 since we started with 23 and we say, Hoshim lekvod rishonim? So Rashi over here has a chiddush where he says that, Hocha dina achrinohu, temikara bal habatoveya, pashta av katava. That there's a change in the litigant here, there's a change in the claimant over here. Originally, it was the husband asking for the reduction of the ketubah, and then once this hazamah happens, the case flips, and now the father is looking for compensation for the knas that he's owed. And Rashi says it's a completely new case, because there's a new claimant. And that new claimant makes it a new case, and if it's a new case, we're not subject to kvod rishonim, and therefore you can start over with three in that case, and you don't have to worry about the 23 that you started the case for the claim of the Baal. That's how Rashi deals with that situation. The Balei Tosafot say about that answer of Rashi that it is dochak. And therefore they explain the case of Tiva'o Mamon is Bishlosha is a case where Hainu Shalo Hitruba Klau. It's a case where there was no Hatra at all. Deleka Mita Ela Mamon. There was no Hatra'ah whatsoever. That would work well according to Abaye. For Rav Papa, you're going to have to come up with another scenario or another way to explain it. Like, for instance, where the woman is not a chaveira, or say that Rav Papa does not subscribe, like Rashi says, to Abaye's position that we're choshishin the kvod rishonim. If we're not choshishin the kvod rishonim, then obviously it wouldn't be a problem for Rav Papa because he never explicitly makes that statement, as opposed to Abaye, who makes that explicit in his position. All right, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Chet Amud Bet, and we'll continue tomorrow with two other answers to the question as to what is the machlokes here between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir.